Thank you for coming. I want to start with a quick survey. How many of you feel like you know pretty well what open source software is? Excellent. That's kind of what I assumed since you came to something that was talking about open source, but I wanted to check first. By way of introducing myself, my name is Ruth Seeley. I work for Red Hat, specifically largely on a project called opensource.com. To start with, Red Hat, I assume many of you are familiar with since you all know about open source software, but the flagship product is Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which began as Red Hat Linux back in 1993. Red Hat went public in 99, now is a pretty good-sized company with almost 4,000 employees and a lot of other products into middleware and cloud. And so we've learned a lot about how open source works well for software. And about 2 years ago, we decided to launch opensource.com to talk about what happens when open source is applied to business and education and government and all of these other things beyond just the software. And so this is a little screen cap of the site. As you can see, we talk about content in six areas: business, education, government, health, law, and life is the everything else channel where we talk about anything that for some reason didn't fit in one of the first five categories. I'm officially the Life Channel moderator, but I write across the site and help keep the thing running. And we talk about open data in healthcare, in open government, and a lot about open business. And that's why all of you are here, is to learn about how you can apply those open source principles into your business and make it better. So just be open. That's really the lesson here. But that sounds scary to a lot of people. Just share, just be open, just put everything out there. That's not what you learn in school, where you have to do your own work and not get help from other people. Or when you first get into the business world and everybody has their trade secrets and their patents and their copyrights and nobody wants to share anything. It's completely antithetical to everything that you learned. Give stuff away, but we're here to make money, right? Show your work to other people. It sounds absolutely insane. Show your work before you're finished. But that means that you get input and you get help and it's better in the end. Embrace failure. We're going to talk about all of these things in more detail, but these are the things that openness means. And you're innovators. Because you're here, I know that you're the ones who can do all of this and make it work in your businesses and change the world. Now, I hesitate every time I say those words because it sounds kind of cliche and goofy to say change the world. Everybody wants to change the world. But openness is changing the world, and that's what we talk about on opensource.com every day. And so what I'm going to do is tell you some stories about how openness is working. And as I do that, I want you to think about how you could apply that to whatever your business is or your project or whatever it is that you want to do. So by the end of this talk, you're going to learn how open source is going to save at least four things. Save money, save 2 million babies' lives, save grandma, and possibly Middle Earth. So when we talk about open source and the open source way, we talk about a set of principles. Because when you say open source, people immediately jump to software. We've started talking about these principles instead. And this isn't a complete list, but it's a good start on what makes open source work for software. And they're good words for starting on how you can apply open source into things that are not software. And so I'm going to walk you through each of these things, talk about how they work in a few areas, beginning with community. Think about whatever your company is, what your product is, or your service, whatever it is that you want to be doing right now. And think about how much better it would be if you were making it with your customers instead of just for them, if you were really listening. OpenStreetMap is a community project that does exactly what it sounds like, builds maps. When OpenStreetMap first really made a difference was after the earthquake in Haiti. This was the map of Port-au-Prince in Haiti when the earthquake happened. This does not offer first responders anything useful in the way of how to help people. It doesn't even have street names on it. Haiti was not a profitable place for people to go and map. Nobody in Haiti has a lot of money to hand over for mapping services, so nobody was heading there to make the maps. So after the earthquake, OpenStreetMap went in, and first they created this. And what those icons start to indicate is places that have beds, hospitals, places that have medicine, places that don't have anything to offer, so you know where not to go. And about a week into the relief effort, they had this. That's the same map that I showed you in the beginning. And if you don't believe that open source made this better than the old way of doing it, this is what Google Maps still looks like today. Aphrodis is a little bit more fun project. It's based on the Elfel, which is an open hardware camera that's used for things like Google Books and some under ice sea exploration in the Arctic. And some people looked at it and said, we could turn this into a cinema camera. Because as photography proceeds, as cinema cameras developed, they became more and more expensive. Because the best way, after we got past film into digital, to make more money was to close everything up inside the camera so that nobody knew what your bits were doing. So Aphrodis decided to take the Elfel, turn it into a cinema camera that you can build for about $700. This is a shot from one of the movies that they've been able to create with it. Transparency. What would happen if everybody in your company knew what was going on? Kind of sounds like the way it should be working, right? But raise your hand if that's how it actually works where you work. Does everybody know what's going on? One guy, two. That's awesome. This is a story from Red Hat. And we have this thing called Memo List. It's a company-wide mailing list that you subscribe to. You are subscribed to involuntarily when you were hired, and you can't unsubscribe from it. This was when the company was 40 people, a place where you talked about company business, memos, as the name implies. It was where you talked about where to go to lunch that day. It was where you talked about absolutely anything that interested you in passing, up to and including bacon, because who doesn't love bacon? But now we have 4,000 employees. And what works as a company-wide mailing list for 40 people does not work for 4,000 people, because the people in our office in Brno do not care where we are going for lunch in Raleigh. So at about 2,500 employees, there was a small revolt, and people were in droves wanting to unsubscribe. About 40% of the company was demanding that they be allowed to unsubscribe from Memo List. And so we formed a committee to figure out how to deal with this. And the result was something called Friday List, because a lot of the more fun threads on Memo List started with, I know it's not Friday yet, but ... whatever ridiculous thing you wanted to talk about, or flame war you wanted to start. So now Friday List has about 60% of the company subscribed to it, and 90% are still willing to be subscribed to Memo List because it's actually informative now. And that was done with a committee of employees from around the company. It was done with input from anybody who wasn't on the committee, and it was reviewed. And it's self-policed. There's no manager who comes in and says, you shouldn't have posted that here, move along. Somebody else will come along and tell you what to do. And what this does to increase transparency in the company is if you do something that is not the open source way, somebody is going to tell you on Memo List in front of all 4,000 of your coworkers. Whole Foods is really good at this transparency thing, too. Who's willing to post their salary to everyone you work with? That's what Whole Foods does. Everybody at Whole Foods knows how much everybody else makes. They know all the numbers for sales. They all know for their teams, for their stores, and that's what everybody's bonuses are based on. Everybody knows every number going in, and so all 6,500 of their employees are considered insiders down to the stock boy who puts the cereal back on the shelf. John Mackey, the CEO, has a lot to say about transparency and how sharing really makes Whole Foods what it is as a company. Tidy Street is a very aptly named little lane in Brighton in the UK, and last summer they started a project to bring down their energy usage. There are multiple studies that show that if people are simply told how much energy they're using, they reduce their energy by about 6 to 15%. And so now a lot of power companies are starting to put a little graph on your bill that tells you how you're doing in comparison to the other people in your area, to other households of your size. Tidy Street took it a step further. They hired a local graffiti artist who did this. Every morning he would go out on the street and all the neighbors could walk out in the morning and see how they had done the previous day, how much energy they were using. Within the first 3 weeks, they had reduced their energy consumption by 15% because every morning, everybody knew exactly what was going on. Twitter, there's a in the speaking green room before you come in here, there's some little cards on the table with speaking tips, and one of them is stick a lolcat in. And I said, all right, I got it. I got a lolcat in. This is a little project that actually started for me last year at South by Southwest because before I came, it was my first year coming here. And I had about 500 Eventbrite invitations. And usually, if I'm going to an Eventbrite event, I print out the little thing with the barcode and they scan at the door. It's like a ticket. But I looked at the number that I had to come here and I said, am I supposed to carry all of these around? I had no idea, but I knew that I didn't really want to carry around all of those printed out Eventbrite invitations. And so I just tweeted, hey, going to South by Southwest, am I really supposed to carry these around? It hadn't occurred to me yet to tweet it at Eventbrite so they saw it. But they did anyway. And that's why I say Eventbrite is doing it really, really right, because they're looking for people talking about them without talking to them. And they responded to me and told me to look at the rules, and I learned when I got here that really almost nobody checks them at the door. Airlines also doing it really, really right. I was on a flight, a Delta flight, to Seattle, and then I was taking a train to Vancouver last August. And when I got to Seattle, my luggage was not there, and I was sad. And then I remembered I had heard a lot of stories, again, beginning at South by Southwest, of people who tweeted at airlines when something went wrong. JetBlue is really good at rescheduling your flights by Twitter, which I find absolutely fascinating. So I thought, well, I'll tweet at Delta and see what happens. And it's Fly Delta, and I tweeted at them, and I said, hey, luggage, where did it go? And they said, oh, we'll help you out. They were much more helpful than the actual in-person people in the lost luggage office in the Seattle airport. Why someone answering me on Twitter wants to help me more than the person I'm standing looking in the eye saying, I have a formal dinner to get to in 24 hours, where is my bag with my dress? Don't know, but Twitter is the secret to good customer service now. And so the next morning, to finish the story, I woke up and I logged into Delta's site, and it told me my bag had been found and the problem was closed. And I said, and yet here I am in my hotel room with no clothes. So I got on Twitter and I said, hey, Fly Delta, my ticket is closed and yet I have nothing to wear. And they said, oh, we're right on it. At lunch, I still had no clothes, and there's a 6 p.m. formal dinner. So one more tweet to Delta. I said, formal wear in 6 hours. Where's my bag? And when I came back from lunch, it was there. I was very happy. And my last example, Subway. I should have begun by telling you, at the end I'll give you a link. If you go to opensource.com/SXSW, you can get links to all these stories I'm telling. And if you go to the Twitter one, I have a whole list. What the Eventbrite one kicked off for me was this 6-month-long study and what happens when I tweet at companies that do something wrong. Subway is doing it wrong. I love Subway because I have a weakness for the Italian urban cheese bread. But when I go, I get mad every time because their napkin says, please recycle me. Well, first of all, you can't recycle napkins that you get oil and vinegar on. You're not supposed to recycle paper with oil on it. Second, they give you a plastic bag every time you walk in, even if all you're doing is walking from the counter to a table 3 feet away. Third, they want you to recycle. All their napkins and cups say recycle, but there is no recycling bin in the Subway at all. I've tweeted Subway about 3 times about this. They don't respond at all. They're not interested in discussing their recycling problems. So really, the lesson here is, if you're going to be on social media, be social. It seems obvious, and yet a lot of companies haven't figured that out yet. Meritocracy is a big, big foundation of working openly. What happens if you get promoted because you're good at what you do and not because you worked there for 10 years? How would that feel? Kickstarter is a good example of the new meritocracy. How many of you have funded a Kickstarter project? That is way above the average. Usually when I ask this question, people are like, what's Kickstarter? The idea behind Kickstarter is something really valuable. It's going way back in time instead of forwards and pulling out that idea of the artistic benefactor and bringing it into the modern day. And it's working out really well for a lot of open source projects, not necessarily software, but open projects. There's one called MuseOpen that is an open source music book, and a similar one called Punk Mathematics, which is a book that's exactly what it sounds like, teaching math with punk music. And one of my favorite uses of Kickstarter is called ransoming. That's what Greg Stolze uses the word ransoming to refer to it. He is an RPG creator. If you ever played White Wolf games, or he created Unknown Armies. Well, at some point he went, I'm kind of tired of this whole publisher mess, and I just want people to use my stuff, which really is what we all want, right? You create something, you want somebody to use it, and you don't want a lot in the way of that. And so he started ransoming his books on Kickstarter. He puts them up, and when they reach a certain funding level, he releases them Creative Commons for anybody. And the people who funded them get printed versions or, you know, extra bonuses for having funded it. Rapid prototyping. I think this is one of the hardest for people to embrace, the idea of sharing what you've done before you're finished, because you're nervous. What if somebody says it's not good? What if it's not good at all? What if I can't show people stuff that's not finished yet? But that's when you get the best input, is before you have sealed it and said, this is the final product. Because at that point, you're not willing to take input anymore. You're too committed to it. You need input before you're done. And if you make anything physical, tangible, you need a MakerBot or a RepRap. It's a 3D printer. The RepRap preceded the MakerBot, and the idea was a self-replicating printer. And the first time I saw a reference to the word self-replicating printer, I just went, oh, we live in the future now. The printer prints itself. These are great little devices, and they're only getting better. And what's really amazing about them is we're getting to a point of what happens if we apply this to healthcare? And there are some people working on 3D printing of biomedical stuff. The easiest is blood vessels, because it's just a tube. You print a circle on top of that, and a circle on top of that, and eventually you get a tube, and you call it a blood vessel. None of that is open source yet, but somebody asked one of the developers of that machine, could this one day be in a MakerBot? And he said, well, the only difference between what I do and a MakerBot is the material you're putting into it. So yeah, it's conceivable that one day you can print all the blood vessels you want. I like to think of it as print all the bacon I want. Arduino is another great rapid prototyping device, as well as the many small open source hardware devices that are coming out now. The Raspberry Pi is the one that came out last week. It's a little ARM-based board that's only $25, and it runs Fedora, which is the community version of Red Hat. Very exciting for us. But this is a carbon dioxide sensing dress that runs on a LilyPad Arduino. The LilyPad is the wearable version of the Arduino. You use conductive thread, and it's washable, and you put it in wearables and make fabulous electronic wearable things. What this one does is it was debuted at a carbon dioxide environmental event, and it senses the amount of carbon dioxide in the air and lights up in different patterns based on that and gives you environmental feedback on your clothes. It's also pretty. Sharing is what it all comes down to, all of this. Everything else, and you can tell as I tell these stories, they could fall into a lot of these categories. But what they all come down to is sharing. What happens if you just share? Share more. And why? Why is sharing important? What happens? This is one of my favorite stories that we've told on opensource.com in 2 years, because every event I've gone to, if somebody still tries to convince me that open source isn't that important, I tell them this story, and they go, oh, grandma, this is the how you're going to save grandma's life story. Karen Sandler, who used to be with the Software Freedom Law Center, found out that she needed a pacemaker. And so she went to the company that made the pacemaker and said, could I see the software code that runs on it? I'd like to see the code that's supposed to save my life. And they said, no, you cannot. No, that's not going to happen. And she said, well, I'll sign an NDA, but if you've written code that I expect to save my life, I'd like to see what it looks like. And they said, absolutely not. The Medical Device Security Center conducted a study and found out that with a PC much like this and a radio antenna, if you have a pacemaker, I can get data off of it and send electrical signals to your heart. Devices that have been approved by the FDA can't be challenged, and the FDA doesn't review source code unless it's asked to by the company that made the device. But if grandma's not enough, we can save 2 million babies. 2 million babies die every year in their first month of life just because they're not kept warm. That's it. They just need to be warm enough. And the traditional lower income advice is kangaroo care, body to body warmth. But in some cultures and for other reasons, that's not always practical. And so then we have the incubator. And most of you are familiar with what an incubator looks like. You've seen them. It's not a problem here in the US. This company, Design That Matters, went along with IDEO into India, where they had GE 1952 incubators that needed a 10-cent part. But it was a 10-cent part that they couldn't get. And so it was an incubator they couldn't use. They found donated incubators where the instructions were all in French. Well, the nurses in India don't speak French, and so they don't really know what to do with them. So their problem was, we can save some babies, but we need a supply chain where we can get 10-cent parts to fix these incubators into the hospitals in India. So this is an incubator that they created with automotive parts, because there is a worldwide plentiful automotive supply parts chain. It was created openly between DTM and IDEO. And yay, babies saving lives. Grandma and babies, we're good. And then there's the fun stuff. Sometimes sharing is just because it's more fun. How many of you are familiar with Ghosts? Ghost was Nine Inch Nails' first album after they separated from Interscope Records. and they decided, along with a lot of other artists, a lot like Greg Stolze, I just want people to listen to my stuff. And so they released it with almost no fanfare or advertising other than a link on their website under a Creative Commons license and offered a few ways that you could pay money for it between free and a $300 limited special edition. That sold out in about 5 seconds. It cost them $20,000 in server upgrades in the first week, but at the end of that first week, they had made $1.6 million. So it kind of worked out for them. Another name that you would recognize that's been embracing the Creative Commons, Kurt Smith, which is half of Tears for Fears. He has decided also, I'm tired of fighting what's often inadvertent copyright infringement. I just want to make music. And so he's using Creative Commons for all of his new partnerships as well. This is a page out of a comic book that I hope will exist soon. It was supposed to be released in spring of 2011, but unfortunately the artist died about the same time, and so it hasn't come out yet. There is another one. They're created by the Center for the Public Domain at Duke University. The first one has been released. It's called Bound by Copyright. But if you're interested in those copyright issues, especially as it applies to music in this case, you should definitely go to the site, and of course, Creative Commons and free, you can go download them. What's great about this is it tells you some of the little stories and how far back these problems go. There's a quote from Plato who said that musical innovation is in danger of the entire state and ought to be outlawed. Plato was against YouTube mashups. There is a case precedent from a case between NWA and Funkadelic, where Funkadelic sampled 100 Miles and Runnin'. It's a two-note loop. They lowered the pitch, looped it 8 times, I think. I've listened to it about 100 times and could never have guessed that they were even vaguely the same because it's 2 notes. It was declared copyright infringement by the courts. And so in that case, the lawyer said, all right, tell us, what is de minimis, which is the word for what is so little that it wouldn't be infringement? And the court said, as little as 1 note. So now it's the next interactive portion, public domain pop quiz. So everything that goes into the public domain in a given year happens on January 1st. It doesn't matter when within its year it was created. January 1st is public domain day for everything. 2012, how many things went into the public domain? Anyone? Guess. 0, not 1. Because when copyright was created, it was for 14 years, with the option to renew for another 14. 28 years and you're done, maximum, you're out. Most people didn't renew, which means that 93% of the books that were written in 1982 would have gone into the public domain this year. But largely because every time Mickey Mouse comes up for expiring his copyright, Disney goes into the courts, and now copyright is darn near forever. 95 years is a nice round number in the middle because it's a lot of complicated math, and if you're interested, I can direct you to some tables that will help you figure out when things exit their copyright. Nothing new is entering the public domain until 2019 in the U.S., These are a few things that you've probably never heard of that would have entered the public domain this year. And this is why I say one cannot simply open source Mortar, because there's nothing we can do about it. So what do you do instead? Creative Commons. I've talked about it a few times. If you're not familiar with it, creativecommons.org. You should learn a lot about how to share more. And there are options. It's not that you don't get to make any money when you release your stuff, when you share your stuff. Like I said, Nine Inch Nails made $1.6 million. And I know in your head you're saying, I'm not Nine Inch Nails. But go look at Kickstarter. Look at how many projects have. I have some friends who just started a game company. $56,000 in 30 days on Kickstarter. It works out. And the last story I'm going to talk about is Pinterest, which has had a lot of arguments lately over whether it's copyright infringement. Is this just a big pot of copyright infringement soup? Well, here's the problem. If you put something on the internet, somebody's going to want to share it. And really, that's not a problem, that's a good thing, because that's why you put it on the internet, right? You're not sharing things unless you want people to see them and to use them. Furthermore, Pinterest, it's really been around for 2 years, but because of the closed betas and the invites and all, we'll say it's been around for about a year. Sites are seeing now that up to 15% of their traffic is coming through Pinterest, because when people pin things, you can click through, you can go to the original site. And so several photographers have said they've seen an uptick in business because people are posting their stuff onto Pinterest. Because even if 999 people come by your photo and go, oh, that's a pretty picture of a fish, when one of them clicks through and buys it, that was a profit. And when two more come through and buy it, that's more profit. And they're ones that you wouldn't have seen if you hadn't gone to Pinterest. And so the story of Pinterest is not that stop sharing my stuff. It's copyright infringement. Stop, stop, stop. If you don't want it to be shared, don't put it on the internet. We're going to share it, and that's a good thing. It's going to help you in the long run. So in a nutshell, share with your communities, whether that's your customers, whether it's partners, people you work with, people who have any vague interest in what it is you're going to do. Share with them. Share more. Share your stuff with Creative Commons licenses. Put it online. Let anybody who wants to see it. And don't wait until you're finished. Release it early, before you're done. Release it often, when you're halfway done and three-quarters done. Keep sharing it. And it's okay to fail. You embrace your failure, and that's how you make something better in the end. Because open source is continuous improvement, not make it once and be done. If you learn nothing else, just default to open. Instead of deciding what you should share, decide what you should not share, because it should be a significantly smaller subset than the things that you do share. And this is how you can find me and how you can find opensource.com. Like I said, all those stories I told and a whole lot more are there, but those, I've put little links to all the stories I've told at opensource.com/South by Southwest. And I thank you all for coming. Are there any questions? Yeah. I think they're coming with a mic if you want to hold on for a second.
So this might be kind of a dumb question, but in the spirit of just being open, I guess, can you talk about, you talk about failure, fail early, fail often, embrace the failure. Can you give us an example of, you gave a lot of good stories, one where failure was an important part of the later success?
You said I did have a story or come up with one right now. Well, that's really how any open source project works. Some things are going to succeed. So imagine a software project on the scale of Linux, because it's easier to think of something at that scale having a lot of little pieces. The way the Fedora-Red Hat relationship works, a lot of stuff goes into Fedora, and then we take some of it and make Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which is stable and secure and ready for companies to use. There's a lot of stuff over here in the little Fedora bits that aren't going to work out. They're not going to make it over here. But somebody got to try them, and then they failed, and that's okay. They get pushed aside so that the good stuff can come to the top. And when that comes down to a smaller scale, I'll use a personal example that isn't really, this isn't a product, but I'll just throw myself under the bus. One of my hobbies is costuming. I do like movie recreation costuming for competitions and stuff like that. I could learn some of my own lessons by sharing those things before I decide to take them out, because my last one, I wandered out, and the first time I saw a picture, I was like, oh, that's not what this was supposed to look like at all. But I hadn't shown anybody. I hadn't seen it other than, you know, looking at it on my dress form. I hadn't really shared it at all. I should learn from myself. So when you fail in small ways instead of failing in big ways. Because if you fail in those small pieces along the way, you won't release the big failure at the end. Anyone else? I saw one other hand.
Thanks for a great presentation. My question is, how do you maintain a competitive edge in a very open, open source sort of world?
It depends on what you're doing, and there are a couple of different open source business models. So the Red Hat one clearly is, the software is open, but we sell support and services and training and all of those things on top of it. There's the Greg Stolze model with the ransoming. You know, once I reach a certain amount of funding, it's free. What do you work on?
I work in marketing services, so you know, it's all about having a competitive advantage for any client that I work on. So that could be from apparel all the way to FMCG. But I mean, I see the benefit of bringing the customer into the equation early. But by doing that, I'm also releasing secrets early.
There is a really good example that it's a company that I used to work for that I've never written about for the site, and I keep thinking I really should. It's a company called Semiconductor Research Consortium. And it's has little people working at it. There are actually only maybe 10 or 20 real employees, but there are gobs and gobs of people who work there. And they're from AMD and Intel and all these companies that have an interest in semiconductors. And they pool together their money for research. And when I first got there, I was like, how does this work? Because isn't that your entire competitive model? But it's what you do with the stuff afterwards. It's your special sauce on top. Figure out what makes you better than the others, and that's the stuff that you can not necessarily, you know, hide behind all the doors, but do more work to protect. And that's what adds value. That's what you can sell, is what differentiates you in some given way. And so that's what all those semiconductor companies do. They get all the research. It's all the same stuff. But then it's what they do with it in the end. Does that help?
I'm curious if the company has any efforts to train or evangelize around openness, or do you just tend to attract people that work and behave in that way?
Do you mean Red Hat?
Yeah.
So I think that has changed over the years. I joined Red Hat about 5 years ago, and there were about 2,500 employees. Now there are more than 4,000, and that is a ridiculous rate of growth. When you're growing that fast and in something like open source, you can't hire people who always know about open source. You have to teach them when they join. And so we're working on getting better at that, because it wasn't a problem in the past. So now we have to figure out, you know, when you have 40 people and you need to hire some more developers, you can hire open source developers. But when you need more HR people and more finance people and some more lawyers and all of those things that aren't coming out of the software community, it's a little harder. And so what we're learning now is how to teach our own employees more about the value of openness. And I hope opensource.com is doing some of that. I have also heard from salespeople about how they're using opensource.com to explain to customers the benefits of openness without talking about software, without getting bogged down in ones and zeros and all of the bits. And that's really awesome, too. So that's exactly what we wanted the site to be, is a way to explain to people the value of open. And I think I've wandered way off your question now. But it's one of the first things that we direct new employees to, a new hire orientation, is go look, because it translates the values that we want to embrace without having to get bogged down in software for people who maybe aren't developers, don't know as much, don't feel as comfortable with the technology. I mean, I'm pretty technologically savvy, but I'm not a developer in any way. I actually work on the brand team.
How do you make sure that, I'm familiar with cloud computing as part of like the open source movement, and Microsoft open sourced a lot of Hyper-V back in the day. And then it kind of, I think their expectation was that the community would just take it up, as opposed to it being more of a collaboration. So there's this moment where when you open source something, you need to put some skin in the game so that other people can contribute. So can you talk a little bit more about those investments that you need to make if you do open source something, so that you can have effective collaboration and effective sharing?
If you have the option, start openly instead of making something and then throwing it over a wall and hoping a community wants it. That's the best way to go about it, because there have been many, many cases of something that was closed, software or not. And actually, the HP TouchPad WebOS is a really good example. They went, well, we're shutting this down, throw it over the wall, here, community, have it. And nobody really jumped in to take it, because that's not the way to do things. You don't just throw it. Really, it feels like throwing something away. Here, take our trash if you want it. So
knowing that there are going to be those people who are going to be late to the party that had a closed system, how do you open it up then?
So that was my next sentence. Okay. I don't think it's hopeless if you do it well. But I feel like you have to stay engaged with it. You can't just give it away. Is that an option for you? Can you still be a part of this community? Or are you trying to just give something away that you don't want anymore?
Oh, personally, I'm just having
hope. I think that is the more effective plan, is to still be a part of that community and help it, rather than just tossing something aside and hoping a community will pick it up, because then you're asking somebody else to be as passionate about whatever you were passionate about last week. And that's asking a lot. And that does happen in open source communities, because there are a couple of different models. Some projects will have somebody who leads it forever and ever, that's the person who created it. And then other projects have, like Fedora has a project leader who changes about every 2 to 3 years. And that gets a fresh perspective in. And so there are models for having someone new with passion come along. But if you want to take something that has not been open and bring it out there, you need to help nurture it. You need to be behind it.
Thanks so much. My question, you talked a little bit about the challenges and issues around copyright law, and then some ways to get around that with Creative Commons. And my question is around patent law and some of the issues that you see there, ways to get around that, and how that interacts with open source.
You could not patent your stuff. That would be step one.
But what about, like, if your competitors then are patenting
right.
things?
So, I'm trying not to keep turning to Red Hat for examples, but it's right there in handy. So what we have is a defensive patent portfolio where we promise that we're not going to sue anybody for using things that we have patented, but it's there for defensive purposes. And I think that's becoming a lot more common in the software industry. More people are taking up that model because for the foreseeable future, software patents aren't going away. There was some hope in 2010, I think, gosh, that's getting to be far back, the Bilski case was the one that everybody was watching. It was actually a business methods patent case. But the hope was that if Bilski got shot down, it was going to kill the hope for software patents. Unfortunately, that's not how it turned out. And even worse, to just keep wandering off into another story, there's a company called Myriad Genetics that patented the breast cancer gene, which seems to me to be the most obvious thing that nobody should have ever allowed a patent on. It's a gene. And so by patenting the breast cancer gene, they were also the only ones who could do the test for the gene for breast cancer patients. It was getting really expensive and taking a long time, and people were waiting to find out if they were dying because of it. So first round, the court shot it down, said you can't patent the gene. It went up for appeal about 6 months later, and they got it back. So, and Bilski was invoked, which is how it was relevant. So right now, Myriad Genetics holds the patent for the breast cancer gene. To which I again say, just stop patenting everything. It's not that patents have no place. I recommend a book, Patently Absurd is the name of it. It has a little light bulb on the cover, which explains where the few places that patents really do work. The biggest one is for pharmaceuticals, because it's really, really expensive to do R&D for new pharmaceuticals, and that's one of the places that patents actually are kind of working. It's starting to break down a little bit, especially for things that are very expensive and needed in third world countries that can't afford them. But it's patently absurd. I should write it down. I'll put it on that page.
So I've got another community building question.
Wait, can you raise your hand? I have no idea where that's coming
right
from.
Right here. I'm the disembodied voice. I have another community building question. So I run a open source software project that has, you know, maybe a couple hundred users and a much smaller number than that of contributors. What would you give as advice for turning around some of the users to actual contributors?
That's a big challenge, isn't it? Can you tell me a little more? I'm going to phone a friend, too, if you want to jump in, Mo. This is another Red Hatter who works a lot with Fedora and is good at community stuff. I think we were using. Is Seven on?
Maybe I'll stand up. Sorry.
Here, meet my friend Mo.
Hi. So I'm a designer working in the open source community with Red Hat. And I don't know, you probably know this being at South by Southwest, but there's not too many designers in open source. We're trying to fix that. And I kind of had the same dilemma. Hey, I have a lot of people hanging around in this Fedora design chat room, and they're not really doing anything. They're just kind of hanging out. So what we started was a program called the Fedora Design Bounties. And this is where I spend maybe 6 hours putting together a little bounty or a quest for something that would have probably taken me 20 minutes to do. But I document it down completely fully. And then we put it up like a contest, like, hey, the first person to claim this gets 24 hours to make progress. So you're putting together detailed instructions on how to do a task, right? You're helping the person build skills, and you assign it to a particular person. You don't just put it out there, somebody do this, because then maybe you'll have 5 people working on the same thing at the same time, and you'll have the inevitable conflict at the end, well, whose thing gets in. So assign it to a specific person. Then they get to feel special. Like, hey, you know, this you know, hacker in this project assigned me something. I have to pull through now. And, you know, at the end of it, they'll have done something useful. They'll have built their skills. And what we've noticed, actually, is people who have come out of these projects end up sticking around and being much more independent, motivated contributors, not just users. We actually hired one of them. Another one moved on to a different open source project, but he's pretty prominent in that project. I think out of the ones that we've done, we've had 5 people, and one of them just sort of disappeared, and the others have stuck around. So I think that's the best way to do it, is just pick a specific person, become their mentor, assign them very well-documented tasks, and you know, the initial investment seems kind of crazy because, oh, I'm putting in 6 hours to get 20 minutes worth of work done. But in the end, you'll have another person who will do the same thing to other people, and it grows kind of like a pyramid scheme, right? So that's my advice there.
Sorry, that was awesome.
So long.
No, that was perfect. And the nugget of that I think is really most useful and applies to everything outside of these communities, like if you need somebody to write the newsletter for your snorkeling club, just ask somebody. Instead of waiting for somebody to volunteer, just say, hey, you're really good at doing blah, blah, blah. Would you do this for me? Sometimes that's all it takes. Just ask.
You've talked a lot about the open source software implications here, but then you mentioned the hardware, the open source hardware movement. And I'm wondering, it seems to be learning a lot from what open source software has blazed a trail for. What do you predict in the next couple of years we see that's different about hardware that will be the breakthrough that makes it just as popular as software?
I think they're getting really close already. There have been two open hardware conferences in New York now, and the second one I think was like almost twice as big as the first one and hugely popular. We're really solidly into the open hardware definition, which was a good start because for a long time, people like open hardware, I don't know, what does that really mean? What qualifies? And that's not solid yet, but we're getting a lot closer. And the biggest challenge, I think, is the cost difference, and that's getting a lot easier too. Arduinos, the board itself isn't that expensive, but once you start buying shields and then whatever you're going to do with it, that's not really a cheap project anymore. Raspberry Pi is getting a little better. When you're down to $25 for a little board, that's pretty hard to argue with. But software, all you need is your computer, which a lot of people had to begin with. That's all you needed to get started, especially once the internet came along and, hey, there's all these people and you can read how to code, you can learn how to code, and then there's a whole community of people that you can ask questions and contribute to. That's super easy. Hardware's challenge is you need a whole lot of other stuff to get started. Plus, it would help if you had a friend who could teach you soldering, and it would help if you had a friend who taught you how Ethernet shields work, and it takes more of a physical community, I think, to make open hardware really successful. Not that it can't work out just being online, but it's harder.
So is that local physical community then?
Yeah, and hackerspaces are helping. I don't know of many major metropolitan areas that don't have at least one hackerspace. I live in the Raleigh, North Carolina area, and we have at least three that I know of. And that's a great place for this to grow. I think open hardware is going to work out really well. MakerBots are taking off. They're everywhere. I don't go anywhere, I feel like, that I don't see a MakerBot. And even, I mentioned I work on the brand team. So the people I work with at Red Hat are about as non-technical as Red Hatters get. They make good designs, and they make banners for websites, and they make videos, but they don't know how to make software at all, and much less hardware. We're working on a project now. If you're familiar with Cow Parade, it's this charitable project where you sponsor a cow, and you can make your cow look like anything you want. And so we had this meeting last week to discuss what our cow was going to look like. And one of these completely non-technical, I don't know jack about open source designers said, can we put a MakerBot in it that would print tiny cows? And I'm like, all right, MakerBot succeeded. Done. No, we're not going to make a MakerBot that makes tiny cows, it turns out, sadly. It's impractical. The cows are outside.
Hi, thanks. Going back to a conversation you had earlier from one of the earlier questions about open source community within your own company, right? As technologists, we're all very familiar with open source and embrace it and can ask compelling questions, but we don't necessarily all work with folks who come from technology. Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned Whole Foods and John Mackey and how they have this culture of openness within the company. Can you talk about a couple of canonical first steps to try and teach your organization how to become open within the way that it makes its own business decisions, or are there some things that are just, like, stupidly bad to do on day one?
Are you in charge?
I'm close enough to in charge to try and influence.
That helps. So in a company, say, with 1,000 employees, Bob in the mailroom is going to have a really hard time affecting culture change. It's hard enough to affect culture change at all. So imagine, like, think back to high school and imagine trying to start a movement where all of the football players start playing Magic at lunch. I mean, trying to affect cultural change is hard, but it helps if you have somebody at the top talking about the openness, talking about the way it should be. If you have a John Mackey saying, look, we're sharing, it makes everything better. It makes us a better place. And explain why. And like I said, that's a challenge we're starting to face at Red Hat as we hire a lot more people who don't come from open source communities and need to learn about why that's good. And maybe in a self-promotional kind of way, I'd suggest that you send them to opensource.com. But find the little ways that you can start. What's the one thing that you could begin opening? And maybe the first thing is a lot of companies don't even have a company-wide mailing list where anybody can talk to each other. I've worked for a couple of places that had no mailing list at all, like they lived in the 80s. Very strange. So that's a good first start. Set up a way for people to talk to each other, because the only way that you can share is if you have a method to share. Then encourage them to use it. Encourage people to talk about what they're working on. And give them a way to do it outside of meetings, sitting around a table, things like that. And mailing lists are really informal. You feel good just chatting, and then somebody mentions the bacon or a narwhal, and everybody's happy. Does that help? I'd be happy to talk about that more. That's a really interesting problem. How old's the company? Yeah, business executives are the hardest ones. Stop hiding everything, businessman. Yeah, it sounds like a crazy sentence. They don't even hear it. Is that all? Thanks for coming. And use the little South by Go app and rate the session. And I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks.